Okay, it's time to welcome a Warrington legend to the show. He played 234 games for the Mighty Wire, also gaining three international caps. We should also add he played 28 games for Wigan, but we don't want to talk about that. 30 games for London, and he finished his career with 67 games at the Chemics before going on and being in charge of the Wolves players, strength and conditioning at the HJ. But now it's all cucumber sandwiches and bottles of Bolly as he's head of strength and conditioning for England Rugby Union team. So what would Brian Bevan say? Warm welcome to the wonderful John Clark.
Thanks, fellas. Great to be on. Great to be on. It's actually smoked salmon and cucumber sandwiches these days. Oh. But yeah, I don't want to put you up on that yet.
Okay. Well, Dennis has got a media pass for the Wolves now. And it's lasagna every week, isn't it, mate? Or pine chips?
Well, I usually ask everybody, actually. So that could be the opening question. John, what's the catering like at Warrington from what you can remember?
Excellent from my memory. I don't know if it's... got any struggling. Better. I've not been there for the last couple of years, but no, it's Heathcote was always pretty good. Boxes were pretty good. I'm not sure about the Wilderspool days though. Post game at Wilderspool. That was a different story.
Happy days. Happy days. Well, you started your professional career at Wigan. Mate, at 18 years age, you played in a Super League grand final, is that right?
I did, yeah. I signed for Wigan when I was 14. And then I started there straight from school on what was probably the old YTS. Apprenticeship scheme where you go to college and you train almost, well, we train more than full time. We go there in the morning at 7:30, train, then we go to college and then come back and train again with the academy or the alliance team or the first team if they were training in the morning. So looking back, I was so privileged to actually be able to do that, because I don't think the guys quite get to do it anymore the way we used to do it. I'm sure it's caused a few injuries along the way, the amount of work we used to do, but in terms of honing your craft and getting down to what a professional sportsman was about, you know, we were doing that from 15, 16, so yeah. And then, yeah, made my debut in 97. We were actually having quite a bad year. Wigan were having a bad year that year, and then we had a game at Bradford. I still remember the old odds, so when Bradford had a really good team and we beat them, we turned them over, and it turned our season around. I think we went 11 games unbeaten then, and yeah, it was actually the old Premiership final, then 97, the last Premiership final, Wigan versus Saints at Old Trafford. Played in that, started in that, and got off to a winning start.
So did you get a medal then, or a ring? You would have got a medal, would you? You haven't changed.
It was a medal. Yeah, it was a medal in 97. And then 98 was a grand final. So obviously still at Wigan then. I played, I don't know if you remember it, Mick Cassidy getting banned for 6 weeks for Elbury and Adrian Morley.
Yeah,
remember that?
Yeah, remember that.
Central Park. Knocked him out. Yeah, it was. And I'd been in and out of the team all year. And then obviously Cass got banned for 6 weeks. So that was me on the bench. As sort of the back row hooker replacement, and unfortunately his ban was up after the semi-final before the final, and I remember being in Central Park gym riding the exercise bike one morning, and John Mooney just walked past and went, gonna go with Cass this week, JC, and I was like,
oh dear.
Can I swear on this?
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I was 18th man. Ended up being 18th man. Obviously we won, got the ring and that, and then it wasn't quite the same as playing.
So was it John Mooney that signed you? Was he there when you were sort of 14 and heading over to Wigan?
Jack Robinson, the chairman, was still there when I was 14. Sort of 96, yeah, 96, John Mooney come back, I think, from memory. And he was sort of our first team coach. I had John Pendlebury. I don't know if you remember him.
Legend Wigan,
incredible player. I was actually just watching a Wembley clip the other day when he knocked the ball out of Ella's arms, yeah. So I had him and another coach, Ray Unsworth, in the academy in the A team, and John Pendlebury in particular. He was an incredible coach for me. Really, really good, tough, straight, but knew the game inside out. Taught us all how to tackle low. He was brilliant.
Sorry, John. Who would you compare him to nowadays? Then, if he was such a good coach now, could you like him to anyone in Super League now?
Do you know what? No, it'd be really tough to do that because he was very unique, Pengy, in the way he used to coach because he used to train with us. And some coaches have got, you can't do that. But if he wanted to show you a skill or a tackle or something, like, he would do it. And he wouldn't talk you through it. He'd show you it. You know, so when we went through this period of 16 years of age, 17, learning how to tackle bigger blokes because he knew we were going to play first team, but we were only 12 stone and we were going to come up. He was teaching us how to go through the middle of people and he was showing us. So it'd be really tough to actually compare him to a coach these days, to be honest.
Pendlebury was very much that pivotal loose forward, you know, in the same sort of shape as Harry Pinner was. You don't see that at lock anymore. What? Why has that changed? Has a sort of loose forward become more a sort of second row player? There's not that sort of deviation that we used to see in the past.
Well, it's a lost art, isn't it? That 13 now. You know, it's just, unfortunately, you know, the ball playing the 13. I actually think it'll come back. I really do think it'll come back, like most things do. But yeah, it's certainly gone. I think most coaches now, they want that sort of extra prop forward, don't they, at 13?
Yeah.
Because the 13 defends in the middle, he has to carry hard. We all play this territory game now, you know, or most play this territory game. So they want that big tackling, big carrying, whereas Pendlebury, Harry Pinner, people like that, they wanted to play outside and play short side and stuff. So they've lost that. So luckily, you know, we were exposed to that type of thinking, which was great.
Do you think that's where maybe nowadays in modern games, towards the back end, particularly with Warrington, you saw two hookers on the pitch towards the end of the game, if one of them's physically bigger like you are, and maybe now we've got Darrell Clark there, perhaps two hookers in the last half of the game?
Yeah, definitely. If you remember, you know, myself, Mickey, Mike Monaghan, we all used to roll around that 9, 13, 6 position just to try and get actually what you're saying has disappeared. You know, the Pendlebury, Harry Pinner, in certain periods of games, like you say, last 20 minutes when defences are a bit more exposed, is actually a real, there could be a real importance for a 13 to be able to ball play as well as the halfback. So, yeah, I think that's why coaches have done that in the past. And to be honest, we did it with great success with Tony Smith. We had we often had 2 9s, 3 9s on at one point, and 2 halfbacks. Yeah. And so, you know, we worked it really well at times.
It seemed to be a sort of a progression that came out of Melbourne. Melbourne were the first to do it, really, and then everyone seemed to copy Melbourne, and it sort of bled over into the English game, I think. But gee, it would be nice to go back to a ball playing 13.
Yeah, I think there was that, and then they had that mix, didn't they? When like Bradley Clyde, I remember Bradley Clyde coming over for the Aussies.
Yeah,
and he was that mix, was he, of athleticism but could still ball play, and then that's just sort of molded, I think, into this virtually an extra prop forward. So hopefully it'll come back. You know, I've got a nephew who's like 15, 16 playing for Warrington and Scott. And I said, if you do anything, I said, you're playing 6 now, make yourself into a 13 and keep your ball playing. I said, because he's, you know, Sean O'Loughlin's probably the last one, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, he's the last one of this era because I can't see any more coming through. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see where it goes.
I remember going to Brookie Oval and watching Manly play what was the old Easts before they became Roosters. And Phil Clark was playing 13 for East, and he just conducted him around the field all afternoon. I mean, not just the determination he showed in his game as well, but he sort of had that sort of instinct of being able to pivot and go back and two, depending on where the play was going. You then signed for London, again under John Mooney. Were you always open to that move to the capital away from sort of the beating heart of rugby league? Did that transfer suit you at the time?
Well, no. Not really. It became about because of my own doing, really. After the 98 grand final, I got in trouble in Wigan. Probably frustrated that John Mooney had not picked me. But I ended up getting in a lot of trouble. January 99, I actually ended up going to jail. I got 18 months in jail, but I served 6 months.
Yeah.
And then I come out and I couldn't get going on that season because obviously I wasn't fit. I hadn't trained. And then at the end of that year, John Mooney signed for London, and everything was a bit raw. I thought, I'm still young enough to sort of go away and resurrect myself a little bit, let things calm down and get my head together. So I went to London with John. I had Andy Johnson sign there. Sean Edwards was still playing there. So me, Andy Johnson, Sean Edwards. Yeah, Sean Edwards, he was playing, and then he sort of very quickly in the off-season, he trained all off-season.
Yeah.
We did all off-season together, and then as the game come around, I don't know if he played one or two, I can't remember now, and he just cut it, and now I'm done. Andy Johnson and Sean were from Wigan. We all lived together. I had the best. The rugby wasn't great that first year, but I had the best 18 months of my life. Like, with living with them, it was great. No pressure. The second year, that second year, Tony Ray took over. We had a really, really good side.
Yeah.
Winning games. We'd signed a load of Aussies. I think it was like the last year of the Virgin deal, from my memory serving right. And
yeah,
they ploughed a load of money into players. We had a great team. But then about May 2001, I think it was, I got the option to, Dave Highton, who was hooker at Warrington, I think he got a bit of a drug scandal. And yeah, I got the opportunity to come back on loan initially, come back for a month and then signed for a couple of years. And then obviously did nearly 11 years with the club, which was, you know, best time of my life.
So when you arrived at Warrington, it was under, I presume, Paul Cullen. What was it like those early days?
It was actually under Darrell Vandeveld.
You were going back that far? Wow.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I'm not showing your age there, John.
Yes, it was Darrell, Alfie, I think Andrew G was still there, but I think he got injured and he was sort of going home.
Were you there when Walters was there? Because I know he was only there for a couple of weeks, but was that just pre-you?
It was just pre. And then we had Darrell for the rest of that year. Like, Darrell was great. He was mad. I loved him. Yeah, he was great.
We've named a particular section of the podcast after Darrell. It's basically tackle bags, because it's renowned that he always used to just say, "Get the tackle bags out." Is that true?
Yeah. I remember. Yeah, it is. I remember one Monday morning after a Sunday game, we were crocked. Like, we had a load of injuries, and he was like, "I don't give a if you're injured." Like, I think Dean Busby was on crutches, and he was going around the pitch on his crutches. He was doing 400 meters on his crutches. Honestly, like, he was bonkers now. And we had tackle bags out day after a game, day before a game sometimes. Not bother. Didn't bother.
Which, I remember seeing him down at Wembley. He was getting his photograph taken with everyone. I think it was when he was still at Castleford at the time, and he was a bit of a Dickie Davis. He had this amazing tan, and he had gold on every finger. Unbelievable.
Yeah, he did. And if you weren't putting your weight in training, you'd get one of them big gold rings on the back of your head or in your ears, I tell you. And he had these massive, he looked like, you know, them big foam hands you get at Wembley.
Yeah.
They were like the size of his hands. He had these massive hands.
Have you taken some of his strength and techniques into your strength and conditioning?
No, definitely not.
So you played with the wonderful Alfie Langer. John, what was it like playing with him? Because even at the age he was at when he came to Wilderspool, he just seemed to float across the park. He had such a low centre of gravity. You know, he could pick big guys up and put them on their back. Just such great vision. Wonderful player.
Brilliant. Just pure class. Pure class on and off the field, to be fair. Brilliant on the field. Leader. Always wanted the ball in the tough situations, which, you know, you can't say that about a lot of halfbacks, but that's usually the sign of the top ones. You know, Alfie, you know, 3 points down or whatever, 2 minutes ago, he demanded the ball. You know, Brazy was the same. You know, in the tough situations, he generally wanted the ball because he knew he could make things happen. I got the bollockings of all bollockings off Darrell on a Monday morning. We played Wakefield on a Sunday afternoon. And we were down, and it was last tackle, and I went myself. I kicked through and I scored. And I thought, great. On the Monday morning, he was like, "JC, I don't give a f- you scored. If Alfie wants the ball, give him the f- ball."
Though you'd won.
Even though I kicked through and scored, but because Alf wanted the ball, he didn't care. He was like, "Get him the ball." he was brilliant.
He went back and played State of Origin, didn't he, whilst he was at Warrington during your stay there then? He was called up, wasn't he? And played a couple of games, went back and won it for Queensland.
And killed it. You know, what was it then? 34, 35 maybe? I don't know. He did it really. Freak, really. Because he'd, any occasion, midweek, after a game, whatever, he'd have a bud. He'd have a few buds, but he never missed training.
Okay.
And always performed. So what can you say about that, really?
Well, talking of having a beer, I remember seeing you more than once in, what's that pub called in Stockton Heath? I've forgotten what it's called now. The Mulberry Street with Mr. Cullen having a pint in there. It must have been great times under Paul. I mean, he's so well respected at the club. We all love him for what he was. And, you know, the way he ran after Andy Goodway in that infamous game against Wigan and clobbered him after being on the ground. He sort of turned them around, didn't he? When he came in, I mean, you were sort of on the verge of going down into the division below.
We were. Well, you know, Daryl left at the end of that year. Then we got Steve Anderson and Dave Plange. They come in. And,
come on, what happened there?
Well, it was just an absolute shambles from the work from the minute go. We had this pre-season. Like, pre-seasons are renowned, aren't they, for being tough. We never got out of breath all pre-season. We just kept doing this passing. Anyway, we lost our first four. Yeah. And this is a true story. He said, guys, this is Steve Anderson. Don't worry. No, we're going to peak about round 11 for the Challenge Cup. Well, he got sacked after round 9, didn't he? He never even got to peak. So, and then obviously Plange took over with my brother-in-law, Paul Derbyshire, late Paul Derbyshire.
Yeah.
And we, again, I remember this really, we had no team. We had lads playing out of position. We played at Wilderspool against that big, very good Bradford team. And we turned them over. Yes. I think we might have beaten 6-0 or something ridiculous like that.
Long-range try, was it Smythe scored down the wing or something like that?
Yeah. We beat them. And we just basically, any chance we got, we just kicked them to death, kicked it out, broke all their rhythm up, and we beat them. But then Cole took over. This season went on, and we were getting beat. You know, we were in trouble, like you said. Cole took over with, and I think, I remember we beat Cass at home. With about two games to go, which basically saved us. We couldn't get relegated after that. Mm. So Cole saved the club. There's no doubt in my mind about that. He come in, he changed the way we trained. He changed the philosophy of what the Warrington club had become a little bit. He started to change that. He didn't get it perfect over the years, but he attempted to. And we had some, we played some great rugby under Cole and had some great times.
To be fair to Plange, though, I mean, it's difficult managing a club while you're doing your pilot's licence at the same time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, he was. I stay in touch with Plange, not often, but when I can, he's a great fellow. Like, he's doing really well, actually. He's doing really well. But when Ando got sacked, got into training the following morning, and the room at the bottom of Wilderspool, Plange had filled it with ale. And he went, boys, forget training. Let's get in here. We got on the ale. And then I think we beat Bradford that weekend with no team. And so it was like, well, this is what we need to do every week. We'll just do this every Monday now.
Yeah. Well, just going back to your brother-in-law, Paul Derbyshire. Yeah. He was very much in the same mould as Paul Cullen. I remember watching Paul play at Main Road in the semi-final against Wigan. And I think the commentators commented on it. I think it was Alex Murphy at the time saying, look at this young lad. He was only about 11 stone wet through at the time, just come into that first team. And I think he knocked the hell out of Tony Iroh that afternoon at Main Road. He had real grit and determination as a player, John.
Yeah, he did. I was actually sat in the stands as a Wigan fan that day, behind the sticks as that drop goal went over.
Yeah, Joe
Lennon. Dabs was... He'd tell you himself, very, very limited skill-wise, but would bend the people. You know, didn't really do much with the ball, but defensively would bend people in half. And like you said, early days, he was like a twig. Yeah. But yeah, very, very, very aggressive, tough as teak, very much in the same mould as Cole. Them two are obviously great mates. And obviously, Dad went into the condition, went to Munster, did a great job there. And then, you know, unfortunately got the MND and... That was very quickly. But yeah, my nephew I was just talking about previously about being the 13. That's actually Paul's son, Jack. Oh,
we've got a good one there, haven't we?
I think we have. Yeah, you know, he's Warrington are after him. Sale Sharks are after him. So yeah, he's gonna be hopefully a skillful version of his dad. Yeah. So he should be all right.
And then, of course, sort of, you know, Paul Cullen, he made way for Tony Smith eventually. Was Paul a little bit too close to the players, perhaps? I mean, it's a different sort of style, I presume, than when Tony came in. Tony, what, was sort of once removed from the players a little bit more, was he?
If you looked at it just in the cold light of day, then you might say, yeah, but it's just different management styles, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, different it's just different leadership styles. And Cole's strength was that, what a lot of Cole's strength was that we loved him. Yeah, the boys loved him.
So you'd do anything for it.
Yeah, and more often than not, we'd go into battle for him. And he appreciated us going into battle for him every week. And that's generally what we did. I know we had a few bad games here and there, and obviously Cole ended up getting the... But that was the strength of that you know, that 3 or 4 years that we had together. That was a lot of the strength, was that Cole brought us all together. You know, we were close. You know, just... I know you like hearing stories, but I don't know if you remember when we went on that unbeaten run. I think we won about 10 games.
Start of the season, yeah.
Was it 2005 or something like that? Was
something
it maybe?
Like that, wasn't it? I think Tony Barrow did about 11 on the run, didn't he? I think they were sort of a little bit earlier in the career. Yeah. Warrington. Yeah.
So we went. We started winning anyway. We won one or two. I think we played in Yorkshire. We called halfway home at Brighouse and started having a couple of beers after games and stuff. And then every game we were winning. So we'd be getting off the coach and we'd be going, PC, where we're going, or are we going, boys, 1-1, we're having a drink. So this just snowballed after, you know, 8-9, then we won 10. Yeah. And then we got the week 11, where we're going to equal that Tony Barrow record. We got beat, and the following morning, he got us in the video and goes, boys, you're drinking too much. And it was great. We had a laugh about it and that, but I thought Cole was from a club point of view just exactly what was needed, from a personal point of view exactly what I needed, and a lot of what the boys needed. But you know, as with most things, it probably was the right time to get Tony in. We had an incredible team.
Yeah,
and we probably, in all fairness, weren't reaching our potential at that time.
Well, I mean, touching on that, and also a few of the listeners have said as well, John, that if you look back at some of the signings that were made in that great side, they weren't Tony Smith that made those signings. They were Paul Cullen. It was almost as if he put that team together. Then you all went and got pissed, and then Tony Smith came in.
Us as players probably play up to that, but we trained under Cole. We trained hard, we trained really hard every single week time we took it, and because that was Cole's makeup. That was part of Cole. You know, that's how he lived his life, and that's how he lived as a player. He trained the house down, and we trained the house down. You know, so it's probably a bit unfair to label that too much, but it was just, you know, Cullen made these signs, he had, and we were on the cusp of doing something really good, but we just needed something, I think, just slightly different. Tony come in and was completely different in terms of personality, way we coached, everything, but it got the desired effect.
Mm. I think you're right there We needed Cullen at the time. We needed Paul at the time. And there was almost like a passion and a pride restored in the club. And, of course, it moved to the new stadium and everything that looked up. But when you live in a relatively small town, if you win, nobody cares if you're having a beer. And if you lose, then suddenly everyone's seeing you out and it just goes around the town. Yeah. It's perception. Yeah, and nobody sees you doing hour after hour in the gym or running laps of the field or doing tests.
I don't have many regrets, really, like looking back, but I would definitely do things differently. You know, and I reckon if you asked 90% of that squad under Cole, you know, we would probably do our post-game drink or get together or what. I'd do it differently again. And, you know, if I had my time again, I probably wouldn't do that. And I'm sure most of the boys wouldn't do that. But you only gain that sort of knowledge with experience, don't you? And looking back at the time, it was what everyone did. We did it. But you're right, you know, Cole, considering where the club was and where it was going, new stadium, he was exactly the right man to lead that and be at the front of that. You know, and obviously we had the Andrew Johns experience. Yes. Within that time, you know, he led that and managed Joey for them 3 or 4 games unbelievably well. So I've got nothing but adulation and praise for Cole as a coach and as a more importantly as a person.
And just touching on Andrew Johns there, John, we only get to see him in the 80 minutes he plays. You know, that's all we get to see. But when a guy like that turns up at training, does he stand out within the first 5 minutes? Are the things he's doing with the ball that are just completely on a different level?
Well, he stood out more because initially because he got a sponsored Mercedes-Benz with his name on the side. And there was about 40 people following him around Warrington in this Mercedes-Benz.
The Pied Piper.
Yeah, and he's coming to training and he was like, mate, you're going to have to get this name off the side of the car. But yeah, I still remember the first session vividly. It's at the HJ and we were just doing a little two-on-one drill. And I've never, ever, ever seen that drill before or since ran or performed like that, not just by him, but by everyone else. He just elevated everyone to a different level than we'd ever seen and probably we ever thought of. And that went through, you know, and unfortunately, we didn't get it right. You know, we were just on the crest of that wave, weren't we? And then we just didn't quite get it together for that whole game and we got beat, but, you know, these things happen, don't they? You know, it's one of them, not something you regret, but just one of them times where you think we probably should have won it there, or we had enough in the time there to win it.
That whole game, you almost sort of got behind on the scoreboard and then sort of played a bit of catch up footy. I think that was sort of it just was pushed a bit. Looking back at that game, I think even Andrew Johns threw a few balls that went astray and led to a Hull try.
Yeah. If I remember, haven't we beat Hull the week before in the last game of the? Beat Hull last in the league at Hull. We beat them there, didn't we?
Yeah. They'd taken Andrew Johns off. Paul Cullen pulled Andrew Johns off, I think, to wrap him up in cotton wool for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, and then I think Hull got a few players back for the following week from memory. So, and we just didn't get going. Like you say, we pushed it, and then people, as I always in these games, sometimes people start doing their own thing, and you lose what your focus of trying to win, and we just didn't get it. You know, fair play to Hull, they turned up from getting a spanking the week before. They turned up and won when it mattered.
So then, sort of, Tony Smith does come in. Different attitude in the training room at changing room at half time. I presume Cull was shouting and telling them what to do and tell them to put their bodies on the line. Was Tony a bit calmer in his attitude towards those sort of coaching talks half time when things weren't going right?
Cole was generally pretty good at half time. You know, and I know what Cole was like as a player, very aggressive. And although he demanded, I didn't often see a real aggressive side in Cole. So he was quite calculated in the way he coached. But Tony was just very different. Again, he was massive on psychology. Massive on delivery of messages, how they were delivered. You know, his big things were, you know, from memory, he'd give you two really positives. Boys, love that. But what about this? We always used to get that. And I don't know how, but that used to stick with the boys really well. We used to always get, it was like a positive shit sandwich, really. You know, you'd have two positives for this negative. We'd always whittle it down to one or two things. And that's why a lot of the times with Tony, a second half, we'd come out and be a different team because we weren't right at the first. But his coaching and leadership and narrowing stuff down, boys, just do these one or two things will have this much effect on everything else. Yeah. That's where Tony's genius was.
About picking out the things that were just two or three or one even small thing that made a big difference, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes as players on the pitch, when you're level with everything, you can't always see what fans and what coaches can see in the stands, you know. So sometimes you need that, you know, you need that telling you or showing you, and that's what, you know, Tony was very good. You know, for instance, we might have had a game plan where we go, right, we are going to go straight through the middle of these guys. But they knew we were going to do that. So their defence used to cram in. But we just keep going and going because that's what we were programmed to do for the week. But then we're going at half-time and go, right, well, they're doing that. You're still running here. Brazy, get two passes out. Boom, let's get the ball wide. We'll hit out wide and then you'll get more chances through the middle. For instance, we used to do that a lot. And then things would snowball from there. You know, the Challenge Cup final. From 2000 semi-final, Challenge Cup semi-final from 2009. That was probably for me tactically Tony's greatest greatest game. We had two game plans. We had two separate game plans for that team. When Paliasino was on the pitch, we weren't going anywhere. If he made four tackles a set, then that was perfect because we knew there's so much around it had happened. But when Paliasino wasn't on the pitch, we knew Wigan were very good, them first three defenders either side of the ruck. So if you know, we actually used to try and play on the edge of them there then, play around the edge. But then as soon as Paliasino come on, we just go boom, 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 right around the ruck. As soon as he got off, back to this. And we just
destroyed him, didn't you, for 20 minutes. Yeah,
we got this game plan and we just perfected. But, you know, that was Tony. You know, that was Tony's tactical nous and genius. And for me, that's the one. I think we did a really good job 2010 Challenge Cup final as well on Danny Badiris. That was another where we just said for however long, it doesn't matter. We knew he was the danger man. And we just sat on him. I was just basically just sat on him from hooker, and I was just sending the big boys at him. And he lasted what 18 minutes. He went off, didn't he, after 18 minutes? And that was pretty much game over.
Yeah. Didn't quite work for him in the Super League, did it, Danny Badiris? Didn't quite get there in comparison to that sort of fantastic displays he put in at Newcastle. Just didn't quite work for him for some reason.
I think there's always two things for me with the Super League and NRL. It is a different game. There's no doubt about that. It's a slightly different game. But the biggest thing for me is that fans, media, players in the NRL all value those players who work really, really hard and who are really, really fit. And Badiris was at the top of that, wasn't he? He'd make 40 tackles, 50 tackles, a couple of carries. His service was great. You know, he played outside Joey. You know, he played inside Joey. And he was the pinnacle of that player for me. Now, when he come over here, he was still doing exactly the same as generally I thought what he was doing in us. But we like that spectacular running, scoring type player more than the Aussie spectators do. That's my personal opinion anyway. So what we value and what we think's amazing is probably slightly different in terms of what the Aussies think.
Yeah. Did you ever get the chance to come out to the NRL, John? Were you ever sort of sniffing around and thinking I'd give it a go over there?
Do you know what I did when I was 17, 18, actually? I'm glad I didn't go now. They folded in about 18 months. Remember the Perth, Western Reds?
The Reds,
When they come, well, our Wigan Academy manager, Wigan Academy coach, went over there to coach their 19s and basically wanted to take me and Paul Johnson with him.
Didn't Barry John Mather go there? Wasn't he there?
I think he did. Yeah, and obviously he'd been in the Wigan team above me. So we were only 16, 17, me and PJ, and it was like, are we going here? And anyway, we didn't end up going. But no, that was probably the only real chance to get to going, really.
Yeah. Okay. Now I've got to ask you this question, John. Why didn't we win a Super League Grand Final under Tony Smith? Looking back in it now, are there moments that you thought, if we'd just done that, if we'd just done this? Those finals, they all seem to blur into one. We were talking about this to Gary Carter last week. We can't really now sort of conclude what happened in which game, but surely there was one there for the taking, wasn't there?
Yeah, I think I'd left this by this stage, but the one where Benny Westwood scored early. When you score, I think. When Benny put one on Blake Green as well, I thought really we probably should have won them ones. I actually think, you know, looking back, that team in 2010 we had and 2011, that should have won two grand finals personally.
The game we lost to that Sinfield penalty in the last.
We got beat there, didn't we? I think that was 2011, and 2010 we got beat at Huddersfield, I think, didn't we, in the quarters, I think, if my memory serves you rightly. You know, two games really which we should have won, but I think 2009, 2010, and the way the league was, so it's still hard to do now, you know, to win the Challenge Cup and win the grand final. I think that was, you know, tough to do. I think because we won back to back as well, looking back, maybe we were a little bit not complacent, but maybe didn't have that drive to go on and win the grand final that, you know, we probably should have with that squad we had. That's, you know, the squad 2010, 2011, really. I thought they were our best chances of winning.
Winning
the grand final, Warrington ever had. You know, I think 2010, I think there was a time at 2010 we had 1 to 17 who were international players. I'm sure there was that was across the team at that time. It was incredible. And then 2016, when I come back to coach, obviously we got to the grand final there. But yeah, looking back, I don't think we got our week right training wise. I think Sandow was injured, wasn't he? You know, he'd done his army in that Wigan game, and our team was a bit cobbled together at the time. So yeah, the answer is, as with more things with finals, you just never know, do you? And these, you know, whether we like it or not now as well, there's that mental block we've got to get over, you know, that mental hurdle that we haven't won it. You know, we've been to, you know, 4 or 5 finals and not won it. And you've got to acknowledge that. For me, you know, as a club now, as a coaching group, Warrington have got to acknowledge that, because that, if you don't, it's a hurdle. And it'll just be sat there all the time.
How do you acknowledge that? Do you go paintballing? I mean, what do you do? I mean, how do you get over something like that?
Sometimes if it becomes too much of a hurdle, you need external help. But a lot of the time, I think it's just acknowledging it and actually speaking about it. Because I've been in teams where you get beaten big games, and the coaches, they don't want to know about it.
Right.
They won't even talk about it, and it's put to bed, and it's sat there lingering underneath, and you know it's lingering. So you know, a lot of the time, it's talking about it. You know. One thing we've done well, I think, with England Rugby Union is predict what the narrative is going to be around the media, around what the opposition are going to say for that following week. You know, when we played Wales in the Six Nations, we spent hours trying to predict what the narrative was going to be for that week, so we could arm the players and preempt the players. Look, this will be coming, that'll be coming, that'll be coming. And that's what I mean, I think, by acknowledging and working out ways of pre-arming the players, so when they get to them finals, or you know, what are them big games, it's they've seen them, they've been there and they've done it.
So I mean, you then, we'll talk about Widnes for a second, then we'll sort of wrap this all up and sort of see how it's progressed from your start of your career to your end. You go to Widnes, you're on that plastic pitch.
Well, it was a funny time in my life, that, because it was me, 2011 was obviously last year at Warrington. I knew I probably needed a bit of a change for the last 3 years. Dennis Betts, who was taking over at Widnes, so he'd asked me to go there and captain them, which I wanted. But it was also Paul Derbyshire died that June. And that affected me more than I ever thought it would do, you know. And I had to, you know, we got to the end of the season and I left Warrington, which was hard after being there 10, 11 years. And I was meant to go into pre-season training and I couldn't go. I walked in my normal clothes and said to Dennis, look, I need another month off. I need another 6 weeks off, mate. I just can't train. Yeah. Missus was dragging me off the rug every night, putting me in bed. I couldn't get out of bed. And looking back, I probably had a bit of depression really over it. You know, I had my sister there with Paul's two young kids. It was a like tough time. And that year at rugby at Widnes, 2012, I was captain. I wasn't fit. I wasn't really, you know, I couldn't really get into the teeth of that week in, week out playing. Didn't play well. Had the plastic pitch, so I was tearing my forehead and elbows and knees off every week, which wasn't great. Yeah. We were a new team coming together. You know, Dennis was a relatively new coach in terms of Super League, and that was a really, really tough year. But we had the crux of actually a decent side.
Yeah.
Got myself together that pre-season, trained harder than I probably had ever done, and got all the other boys as well at Widnes, tried to just lead properly as a captain, and we trained like mad that year. Yeah. End of that year. And the following year, as a team, we had a great year. I got player of the year. We got, you know, we beat a lot of big teams. And then the following year, you know, we kicked on a little bit as well. So it was a great 3 years. I've got some great memories of Widnes. I know there's a huge rivalry between Warrington and Widnes, but made some great friends there. Met some different lads who I'd only ever played against. Dennis Betts was great as a coach. Learned a lot from conditioning point of view, because that was another reason that I wanted to go there, because I knew I wanted the line of work I was going down, and I perhaps didn't want to do that at Warrington straight away. I haven't been there 11 years. So, my long-term plan and sort of vision for where I wanted to be was sort of fell into place nicely, really.
Did you take the plastic pitch was a good thing then? Because you've got it in your back garden now, haven't you, John?
Yeah. Have you got a drone?
Oh, listen, we do our research here, you know. We're talking about drones again. Yeah. So apart from taking a bit of the pitch with you from Widnes, is that where you sort of then started taking the fitness side of it seriously and making a career out of it for the future?
Well, the pitch was an interesting one, wasn't it? Because it caused a lot of controversy, really. And I think, you know, looking back, I'm not sure it was meeting the rules and regulations initially that first season. It was like landing on bloody concrete. Honestly, it was. But yeah, it was. What it did do, it made for, you know, because we trained on it every day. We got used to it. So over the course of that first year and then that second year, teams couldn't play against us on there. Because we played such pace and we knew exactly what to do, knew how to kick on it, you know, so it became a real advantage. So it was great.
Well, thanks for the scoop anyway. We've now known that it wasn't up to the regulation standard at Widnes at that
that's
point.
That, by the way, that was only my opinion. I'm not sure if that was gospel or not, but that was just from what I could. Well, every time, after every game, I'd look at my elbows and knees and my forehead and think, this can't be right. That's all it.
Did it almost make it? It almost makes a completely different game. Then does it?
Touch footy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We would literally whip the ball side to side because we knew we could. It was fast, and you know when it's particularly dry. And what it did do when you weren't used to running on it, it sap your legs, or it stiffen your legs up. So other teams would come in; they'd not trained on it all week. They trained on soft grass, and then they come on this, and it was like it was hard. And it just sap your legs, your calves would cramp because your system wasn't used to running in that way. Cramp, hammies would cramp, hips would cramp. You know, they were taking bangs and knocks and not falling the same. You know, that was a big thing for us. I think we learned how to fall on it. Whereas other people, they didn't really know how to fall on it. So they just land face first as we were doing first. You know, the shoulders were going. But we got used to this. So it became a huge advantage for us. It was, after 12 months, I actually really enjoyed playing on there. But initially, it was, especially when I was 33 as well, you know, so things were getting stiffer by the week anyway. And train on that, mate, it was hard work.
Well, that's my next question, John. 359 games of Super League, 3 games for Great Britain. What wear and tear has that taken on your body?
Plenty. I look at other eras, you know, the Culls, you know, and the people like that before. And then I look at them, I look at the state of some of their knees and shoulders. Yeah. And I actually feel quite blessed that although our medical services probably weren't what they are now for players, they were still to a standard where, you know, I can still get about, I can still run around with my kids, I can generally do what I want. So, yeah, I've got a hip tear and I've got plates and screws and the brakes and all that. But generally, I'm pretty healthy. So I can't complain too much.
Well, just moving away from your career in a second, but one last question we have to ask you is, who was the best player you ever played with at Warrington?
It's a really difficult question that because I've got a few players who I really really enjoyed playing with for different reasons and who are probably. For the reasons I give you, they were probably best at what they did. You know, Brazy, you know, he's your first one. Brazy was amazing for all the reasons. Brazy was amazing. He was a nightmare as well at the time, but he was
still
amazing.
Is. Yeah,
and he is. But that's Lee, and that's what made him amazing. You know, so he would be top of the list. Brett Hodgson, he's the best fullback.
Yeah,
that you know, and I played with some good fullbacks, Connolly, Radlinski. But Hodjo, his reading of a game and knowledge of a game is like nothing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like Nathan Wood, Benny Westwood, they're the best for getting lads to play with them and wanting to play with lads. You know, I couldn't wait to play with Nathan. I love playing with Benny Westwood. He was incredible. You know, Louis Anderson. As a second rower, Louis, for them 2 or 3 years we had at Warrington, he for me, he was probably the best second rower in the world at the time.
Yeah.
There's no one, you know, so to actually pick out one or two players is actually really difficult, because he's I've probably got five or six, you know, Mozza, like,
yeah,
just unbelievable what he did. So, yeah. I think, you know, as a natural talent, actual, if you just went into it on talent, Joey's probably the best player that I've played with all those two or three games. His ability is better than probably anyone's. But if you're looking at that week in, week out, and for different reasons of why I enjoy playing with these players, and that you know, they're probably a hand-picked few, really.
But as a coach, I mean, there's no question it was Steve Anderson, yeah?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. I'm still waiting to peak.
Oh, dear. Well, let's move on to your strength and conditioning, John. When did it sort of become an inkling to think, this is what I want to do in life, this is where I want to go after I finish my career as a rugby league player?
Well, one of the things like you do as you get older, but when I've certainly done it, you know, with some help, is try to piece things together in my life and try to understand why I'm where and what I'm doing now, why am I there. And I used to race BMXs as a kid before I played rugby, and I used to train every single day from being 4 or 5 years of age. And then I moved into rugby at 9, and I used to train every single day. And then I moved to the YTS scheme, and I'd be training. And so all I've done from 4, really, is trained every single day of my life. And I got to sort of middle of 2005, 2006, and I just had this incredible interest. I just love training. I just absolutely love training. I then thought, well, what am I doing here? You know, we trained in a certain way, and then I started to question, is that the right thing to do, or is that? And then we got a conditioner called Paul Strudgeon, who's actually does my job now at Wales. Now we sort of go head to head a bit now. He come in and just blew me head with training,
right?
And so like this is, I was like, shit, this is what it's all about. So in 2007, I went to university while I was playing, did my sports science degree over 4 years. And then I had a year off. So that started to give me some more background knowledge of what I was actually trying to do and what I wanted to do in terms of the rugby. And then I had a year off my testimonial, went back, did my master's in strength and conditioning. And that just sort of set me on the right road of trying to work out what this training was all about. And then because I had this experience of playing and being around boys and sort of knowing how to interact with players, and then I had some knowledge then of actually what was happening training wise, the natural progression for me was to go down the strength and conditioning route, because the bottom line is I absolutely love it fascinates me, you know, trying to get the boys to a different level. Can you make an improvement there? Why has that happened? Why has he pulled his hamstrings? You know, why has he performed amazingly that week but then the following week he's not? So there's all these things, and that's the route I'm on. And rugby league was obviously the natural progression, and then I got this chance to go to England and be part of the World Cup. So I feel very privileged to be in the job I'm in, because there's not many of these roles knocking about now, and I feel very privileged to have learned and played and been coached from a rugby point of view and an S&C point of view by the people I have.
Yeah, you're very charismatic, and all we hear from the players is that they all loved you. Everyone liked to be around you, to do what you're doing as a job as a strength and conditioner. How much does that help? Because surely if a guy comes in who no one respects, it must be harder to get them to lift those weights, to make that extra run up and down the field. It must really help, John, coming from that background of playing for Warrington.
Yeah, it did. So I always, you know, I had a bit of a jump start probably on a lot of people. Because of the play and that type of thing. But the one thing I always try and do is with the lads is I just be honest with them, and that, you know, and they know underneath what I'm asking them to do, there's two things that are the crux of it. One, I want them to do well, and two, I want the team to win. You know, I'm a winner. That's all I want to do. I want to win. And sometimes I'm sure lads have hated me what I've said to them, or said, you know, and I'm looking back, I've probably got a few things wrong as a conditioner about the way I've said things. But the crux of where it's coming from is honest, and it's for the right reasons, that I wanted to win and I wanted the club to win and I wanted them to do well. And I think lads generally know that about me. So, and I think that's where they respect, and, you know, we get on well, we have a laugh. So yeah, you know, it's it, no, that, that, you know, that that's nice to hear. And the one thing I've always tried to be is just honest with the boys, and I think over a period of time they respect that.
Yeah. Ben Curry tweeted this week that he was trying to work out who would be dreading the scales the most when Warrington do come out of isolation. He said Tommy Lynham. Who was the player that, when you were at the Wolves, that was always at the Burger and Chips? Who's the one that you always had to keep an eye on?
Benny Westwood.
Was it?
But Benny was like, and this is, you know, players have gone, well, what about Benny Westwood? And I said, Benny Westwood, get this through to your head. He is a freak. I don't think I've met anyone since, and I never will, who can do what Benny does. And that's have a fried breakfast on a game morning, and not then nothing else till the night kickoff, and play like an absolute man possessed every single week. Yeah, I said, don't bother training it, because you cannot do it. I guarantee it. I've tried it. I can't do it. So, Benny was up. Benny was up. But, you know, I'll give Benny his due. And, you know, going back to the respect thing, you know, when I took over at Warrington for conditioner, Benny in his way, this was about 4 months into my conditioning job at Warrington. He come up, he said, I'll just let you know, John, I haven't missed a session yet for you. And all I know, well, thanks very much for that, Benny. I appreciate that, mate. But yeah, he was always, but I think the way sport is now, you know, being overweight and not in shape is very, 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 very difficult to get away with now. Very difficult.
This is the time for the Weetabix question, isn't it?
John,
would you advocate Weetabix for breakfast? I mean, I've been trying to for the sponsor for the podcast, and being that I'm the world record holder for eating 12 Weetabix in 1 minute 31 seconds, and I have eight Weetabix for breakfast every morning, what's your opinion on the best breakfast other than a fried breakfast?
Well, it's Weetabix, isn't it? For sure.
Oh, do you pay much attention to the nutrition side of it with the fitness and conditioning then?
Yeah, it's huge. We have, you know, at Warrington, we had a virtual full-time nutritionist at Warrington when I was there. It's massive because, you know, you are what you eat. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, we have boys at the England who train like mad, but we've still got a couple of little issues in and around, and it's because of what they eat. And this will always be, this will always be the case, and that's the challenge. Can you get them on the right page?
What's the root of all evil, John? When it comes to a diet, is it sugar? Is it carbs? Beer? What's the one that you're trying to get them away from all the time?
Rob's diet.
Well, it's nice. It's funny you should ask that. We actually had a Skype with our nutritionist yesterday, and we've been round every single avenue you could think of with lads. You know, low carb, high fat, intermittent fasting. The top and bottom line of it is if you consume more calories than your output is, you will put weight on. Simple as that. And that doesn't matter whether the calories are coming from protein based, carbohydrate based, vegetable based. If your calories that you are consuming is higher than your energy expenditure, you'll put weight on. So one thing we've done now with the boys to try and give them a little trigger is that we've said to them, if you are hungry, you're burning fat. If you're not hungry, you're not burning fat.
Right.
And it's been revolutionary for them. It's really good. And actually, there is some science behind it. The hunger and the fat cells emptying and this type of stuff. So there is a bit of science behind it, but it's a really nice trigger because, I'm hungry. There's a stigma around, don't let athletes get hungry. You can't let athletes get hungry. It's bad for them. Well, it's bullshit. For the boys that need to lose a bit of weight, being hungry is actually a really good thing for them.
That explains why, then, that I've not been hungry since we've gone into lockdown, and I seem to be about 4 pounds heavier already.
you've not been hungry since you were 12.
you're probably quite right. You mentioned there about Ben Westwood not missing a session. Obviously, when you're in a club day to day, you're seeing players at least five times a week. What's the difference now with England when you're only seeing players on get-togethers or around the Five Nations or summer tours? How much more difficult is it to keep them doing what you want them to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. Club land is relatively easy because you have this daily contact with them where they pretty much do what your program is. But but the way the RFU is and the relationship with the clubs are all privately owned. So the club, you know, the clubs want their say. We as a, an international setup, we want our say, because there's a disparity between the club intensity and match play and what international is. So we have to try and bridge that gap, and it's a real balancing act. And your, shall we say, your communication skills and your relationship building skills have to be on point all the time, because it's a constant negotiation, relationship build with club S&Cs, with club owners, with club DORs. So it's tough. It's really, really, really tough. And if you look at our last Six Nations just gone, you know, we weren't in the shape at the start of the tournament as we were at the end. You know, there was nobody going to beat us at the end of that tournament, because we got them to the place where we want to get them to from a conditioning point of view. But when they come to us, they weren't in that shape. And that's no disrespect to the clubs. That's just that club intensities aren't what international intensities are. But we're the only one of the only international organizations who don't get much time with them and don't have much say. You know, Irish, all the players are centrally governed, so they have full control over their programs, whereas we don't. So we've got 10 days to basically get them in shape before that first test, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And in terms of sort of strength and conditioning across the two codes, I mean, I remember going back to the days when, you know, rugby league players were professional. I mean, Wigan went to the Twickenham Sevens and absolutely destroyed everyone. I mean, they were just in a different world in terms of fitness and physicality.
Yeah.
Also, there was that Wigan-Bath game, whereas I think, you know, the Bath-Wigan score was pretty close when it came to rugby union, but it was embarrassing, the league game.
Yeah.
Has that distance between the two sports now disappeared, John? When you went to union, did you see any difference in the conditioning and the fitness of players in union in comparison to Warrington?
The biggest difference I could say is that if you look at rugby league teams, it's quite a generic athlete. You know, you can get prop forwards playing on the wing.
Yeah.
And you can get wingers playing at halfbacks, and you can get halfbacks playing at centre. And as we spoke, you can have 13s playing as a prop. Rugby union, that just does not happen. The specialised positions and specialised body types, really.
Yeah.
So the front rowers, you know, they are very unique in the way they are. The second rowers, they're unique generally. The back rowers are unique. The outside backs, inside backs, they're all generally, they're quite unique in the term. Backs not so much, but certainly the forwards. So the way you the demands on them as players is very different. It's not as general. It's quite specific to what they need. So from a conditioning point of view, you have to have a lot more specificity really in terms of what you do positionally. Yeah. With the players, that would be probably the best simplest way I could explain it to you. Yeah.
Tony Smith commented a few years back now that he thought that rugby league was going down the path that we're just going to end up with utility players. Everyone's going to be the same size, a certain you know, certain dexterity to the way that they perform on the part. Is it because of the rule changing, or is it just the fact we've found a winning formula how to play rugby league, and that's the kind of player you need?
I think because rugby league is such a tough game. Like, if you think about all the physical qualities you need them all to play rugby league well, generally. Yeah. It's probably only Brazier who's ever got away with not being right physically and then and being really successful. You know, but, you know, you've got to be fit. You've got to be strong. You've got to be, you know, you've got to have pace. You know, you've got to be aerobically fit. You've got to be anaerobic. You've got to have all these qualities. So because you have to train like that, you create a bit more of a generic athlete.
Yeah.
So, and then you bring in the rule changes, you know, you take some substitutions away. So then those massive islanders that you had for that period of time,
yeah,
they become a little bit more the same as what the other boys are.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't take them on, put them on and off after 5 minutes. So yeah, I think it's a combination of what the game is and the rules and the external factors that feed into that as well.
Have you viewed Luther Burrell's transition through? Is it Burrell or Burrell?
We had him down as Burrell when he was playing Union, but we're calling him Burrell now, John, because he's come up north.
Yeah.
That's the way it's...
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah.
How have you viewed his transition, John?
Yeah, mixed really, isn't it? And that's a perfect example, isn't it? If you look at what Luther was when he was at Rugby Union, he was a big boy. Like, he was a big lad. But he might only get the ball three times and make three tackles at centre in Rugby Union. So he could make that blockbusting. Now, he's come to rugby league and he's lost 8K. Yeah, he's lost. Yeah, he's lost 8K. But yeah, I'm not talking about his rugby, but you know, from a physical point of view, he's had to lose 8K because the game's different. And yeah. And if you look at what he now looks like the rest of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's gone down the vegan path. Is that something that you sort of promote? I mean, I think Mike Cooper went down it, but he just wasn't having enough protein and he's back on a bit of meat. But it seems to be the trend at the moment, doesn't it? Veganism's the way to go at the moment.
Well, yeah, it seems that there is a really interesting stat, though, I think, isn't there, around veganism, that 80% of people who go to veganism end up back on meat.
Well, they all go to Benny Westford's van, food emporium. Well,
exactly. But what I will say from nutrition is I don't actually think there's any issue from having a day or two a week where you just eat plant-based foods and you don't eat meat, or you become a vegetarian and then you have meat for 3 or 4 days of the week. I actually think if you could get that, I think that would be a perfect scenario. And then if you could
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what's wrong with that? But if you could then, I think what this is the key is it if you can match your calorie intake to what your calorie output is, well, then you're laughing. And then you build your different foods in and around that. And then, you're healthy, you've got energy for what you need to have. And you're generally, the key is to have general good health, isn't it? That's what we're all chasing.
This lockdown now, of course, is stuff we've seen on Instagram that all the players are taking to their exercise bikes. We should point out that Dower Clark's not got his feet in the pedals. But what fitnesses are they missing out on when they come back on their return in both league and union? What can they not do? What's the difficulty going to be when they sort of hit the park again?
Well, they can run aerobically, so they can run aerobically. They can do repeat efforts. They can do all that. There's a couple of big things that they're missing. One is the strength work, because they haven't got the gyms that the clubs have. Yeah. So they're really missing out on that. And strength is probably the number one quality that you want to underpin everything. You've got to be strong. That underpins most things. So that would be the first thing. That's the danger for me, is that these lads have chronically lost strength. The other bit is they haven't had any contact. And what I mean by that is tackle contact within, carrying the ball, getting tackled, tackling someone else. When you pass the ball and you get clobbered, they haven't got that. So they haven't got the specifics of what rugby is about. And the big question is, at the minute, this is the question, is how long do players need to get back to being able to play the game?
This is why we need Daryl Van der Velde's tackle bags as a brand item that we can sort of sell. And, they can start doing the contact in the back, figurine them up in different sort of characters.
Definitely.
There's been a few coaches that have sort of been quoted in the last week or so, John, that when we do come back, that we might have to play shortened games. I mean, Gary Hetherington's looking at maybe possibly 3 games a week. Brian McDermott's mentioned that we should sort of be playing 60-minute games. Is that feasibly possible?
The 60-minute thing. I don't think that's relevant, personally. Because if you, the other bit is, it's all relative, isn't it? Warrington are not going to be at the best, but neither are Wigan or Wakefield. So it's relative to the league, isn't it? The lack of fitness and the lack of strength is relative. Yeah. It's not that there's not that 3 or 4 clubs are going to be pristine and the other lot. It's all relative to each other. So I think that's the first bit to consider. The 3 games a week, like. That might last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and then you run out of players because everyone's injured. So you're gonna go into a game where lads are underprepared, because that's the reality. They're gonna be underprepared when they first go into that first game. And then you're gonna ask them to do more load than they've ever done. And then expect them not to get injured. The biggest thing with injury is, if the load is greater than the player's capacity, they will get injured. So how can you then say, well, they're going to have two games a week is going to be too much. It's going to be too much, because they haven't got the capacity to do it, because they haven't trained properly. So how can you say put 2 games on a week? Now, the reality of it, they might have to, but what's going to come with that is, I would imagine, a surge in injuries.
In all this isolation, you're the person to come to, John, in terms of fitness and getting everyone healthy and keeping everyone sane. I mean, moving away from footballers for a second, just the average fan that's sitting now at home, that possibly, I don't know, has smoked all their life, has been drinking all their life. I mean, these two are classic examples, Sam and Dennis. They're about to turn 50 both. the hardest thing is to break that monotony, isn't it, and get fit. What would be your advice to someone that's done no exercise for the past 10 years to get back on the bike and do something about it?
Well, I heard a quote the other day, and I'm going to start using it, and I think it's really pertinent at this sort of time. If you're not moving, you're dying.
Right.
And I don't think it really matters what you do too much. You've just got to be moving. Yeah. You've got to be moving. You've got to, you know, if you walk around the garden and you stand up, you know, you sit down in a chair and you stand up again 10 times, 3 times a day, well, you're moving. That's movement. So you've got to keep it. You've got to give it a bit of perspective and a bit of context at the moment. But a couple of key things that I try and do, and this isn't a bit out there. This is where I think the world is going, and it's certainly where training is going. I think every person should have a breathing practice or protocol or some sort of breathing training that they're working to. The breathing underpins everything, every little bit. And, you know, because of evolution and the way we are, most of us don't breathe correctly, even though it's automatic. So actually training yourself to breathe, if you could just train yourself and do nothing else, that would be a great starting point. And there's so much stuff on the internet. You can learn how to belly breathe. You can learn how to do this, that, and the other. But the big thing for me is to get up and move. Have a little routine and get up and move. And the other bit, which we've touched on, is match your nutrition to your energy expenditure. And the reality is, at the minute, our energy expenditure is lower. So why are people still eating the same amount of food? You don't need it.
We had Carl Fitzpatrick on the show, and A.D. Gardner's put him on peanut butter with bananas. Is there a superfood that you recommend, John, we should all be eating?
Apart from Weetabix.
Yeah. Well, Weetabix are a staple part of my diet, I tell you. Yeah, I love them. Well, you know, people say about the fruit, don't they? But again, like, you know, the fruit, and again, and I'm not bagging what, you know, peanut butter and bananas. They're really high calorie foods, aren't they? So at the minute, if we're talking now at the moment, you know, for me, the more vegetables and the more thin skin berries and the more white meat you can eat, I know that's tough with some of the shopping and the bit of fish. And for me, it's basics, isn't it? That you want to do the basics really well. You've got to do the basics are, you should be having between 5 and 10 pieces of fruit and vegetable a day.
Yeah,
and the big thing at the minute, you want to stay healthy, and the big thing is stay hydrated, eat plenty of fruit and veg, and breathe properly.
You know, you sound very much like a guy I was reading about the other day, John, called Drew Povey on leadership, and he was talking about acceptance, adaptation, and ambition. I'll be honest, I only picked that up off your Twitter account because I have been obviously following you around it.
But trolling me, but that's fine.
Yeah, I'll put you in a trolley. So as you're now, you know, leadership's a big thing for you. In this lockdown, I mean, obviously the first thing is, like, you know, you accept it, which I think we all do, and we, you know, adapt, which is what you've just talked about. From your point of view, where you are now, and not so much the lockdown, what's your ambition? Because you've reached pretty much a top of your game where you are now.
Yeah. You could look at it. I think at the minute, the biggest thing I've got in my head is, with this situation, is it would be very, very easy, wouldn't it, to use this as an excuse. You know, you could use this situation as an obstacle, as an excuse. But actually, it's a huge opportunity for so much else, isn't it? You know, even what I've done this morning with, like, Skyping the boys, it didn't work, you know, Zooming the lads and doing a training session or whatever. Like, it wasn't perfect. But I know over the next few weeks, and actually, you know, the issues that we're having around with the lads training from clubs, it might actually be a way. We might have created an opportunity this morning for the boys to train better remotely long term. So that's my thought process at the minute. One, accepting it, as you just said, and how do we adapt to it, and how do we create opportunities out of it? I've managed to get all my to-do list done off my laptop, which is great. And, you know, and other things around the house, and spend time with the kids. So yeah, it's not great. I'm not saying it's a great situation, but it's a huge opportunity to do so much other things. And in terms of my job, my role, you know, in terms of head of performance or head of conditioning, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's very, very tough to get any higher, really, than sort of where I am at the minute. But I'm hopefully just about to sign again to the new next World Cup, so that'll be the next sort of 4 years taken care of. So, yeah, you know, I'm not looking too much further than this job at the minute, and just trying to work out how to make the most of it.
Maybe a Lions tour when they eventually come back.
yeah, well, that's the pinnacle, and that's, you know, in my own space. Yeah, that's something I would, but that's out of my control. I can't control that. You know, that's somebody else's opinion to come in and ask you to do it. So that's nothing to do with me. I'll just basically trying to keep doing my job as best I can, make sure that every time England get on the park, you know, the players look fit, and trying to influence where I can, basically.
And then go for a drink.
But you know what? I tell you what, once this corona's finished, there's going to be a big party somewhere in Grappenhall, I'll tell you.
And will we ever see you back in league, John? Do you think you'll ever be back?
Never say never, do you? Never say never. I love Warrington. You know, I think one thing conditioners do as they get older, they become consultants for numerous teams or organisations. And, you know, not yet, but, you know, in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, consultancy around this job, I think, would be something I'd look at. So you might end up back at Warrington or, you know, or in rugby league or whatever doing that. So, yeah certainly never say never. And I love Warrington as a club, as you know. I played there for a long time. I've still got some great mates. Great mates there, you know, on the pitch and also board level within the staff. So I'm very close with Pricey, obviously. You know, so yeah, I just hope they do great. If I can help them anywhere along the line, you know, trying the best, and I will do in the future. And, you know, I just wish everyone involved with the club the best of luck.
Well, I'm sure from the podcast and from all the fans, we'd welcome you back in a heartbeat, John. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thanks for your time. Stay safe, stay well. And we wish you all the best with England Rugby Union team and whatever lies for you in the future.
My pleasure, fellas, and thanks for the invite and thanks for the opportunity to do that. I've loved it.